this morning. So I'll begin, even though there will be people wandering in, and there are a few introductory remarks that I wish to make. The reason that this presentation is made at this time are several-fold. Primarily, it is an answer to a request by the Bethel Bible Series people here with Pastor Tollefson and his associates from Beaverton, Oregon. And they asked that I give them my 10 laws, not realizing that the laws had expanded in an interim. So you're getting a considerable part of a whole load of hay this morning. I should say regarding my laws that I have been working on them for many years to define for myself how I regard various matters. Ordinarily, I like a discussion situation such as koinonia. But when you're giving laws, you stand at the pulpit, and to save time, I will stay quite close to my text, which is something too I'd rather not do. The first time that I gave these was to a colloquium of scholars at California Lutheran College, and it's changed a great deal since that time, Rudy. It was something Rudy set up at California Lutheran, and he had a bunch of people in. To scholars, and then they brought me as an add-on for the evening, for the laughs in the evening. I am here too because Carol Hinderly had these two reserved, and I said, all right, what I'll do is split with you. He wanted me to take them both, and I think it's very important to all of you, far more important than hearing me, is that you hear Carol in Bible study, and he'll be on here tomorrow, and I hope you bring your friends. He's the best Bible teacher I've ever had, and that's one of the reasons I come here to hear him, and I can't hear him when I'm up here speaking. So you'll hear him tomorrow. I apologize for those of you who were planning to hear him this morning. What I'm going to say to you this morning is not particularly scholarly or erudite. In fact, it's rather simple. And by way of explanation, I'll recall for you an event in the life of Charlie Brown, with whom I identify at this point. One day, Lucy and her brother Linus and Charlie were out, and it was a day like very early this morning when there were a lot of fleecy clouds out there. And Lucy commented that, aren't those clouds beautiful? And then so they all went up on sort of a small hillside, and they all lay down on their back and looked up at the clouds. And Lucy said, I could just lie here all day and watch the clouds drift by. If you use your imagination, you can see lots of things in these cloud formations. What do you think you see, Linus? Linus confidently makes the following observations. Well, those clouds over there look to me like British Honduras in the Caribbean. And that those clouds over there remind me of the outline or the profile of Thomas Eakin, the famous sculptor and artist. And over there, those clouds to me recall the life of the stoning of Stephen. I can see Paul over to one side. He is interrupted at that point by Lucy, who says, that's pretty good. Linus and Charlie, what do you think you see? He says, well, I was going to say that I saw a ducky and a horsey, but I changed my mind. I haven't changed my mind. I'm going to tell you about a ducky and a horsey. It is probably unnecessary for me to tell you that in biology, or in science generally, we have a lot of laws. Chemists and physicists use far more than the biologists because they're more legalistic and pietistic. The most famous laws in biology are called Murphy's Laws. And since they generally have general application, I'd like to review a few of these with you to put you in a mood for mine. The first one is that nature always sides with the hidden flaw. Number two, if everything seems to be going well, obviously something has been overlooked. Number three, left to themselves, things go from bad to worse. Number four, anything that can go wrong will go wrong. And fifth, if there is a possibility of several things going wrong, the one that will go wrong is the one that will do the most damage. so far for Murphy's laws. My first law states that people have been allotted 2 ears, but only one tongue and one mouth, and that for some very good reasons. Now, I won't give you the whole load of hay on this, because I usually take about an hour to tell you about the art and importance of listening. I will recall for you what an American Indian said: listen or your tongue will make you deaf. And the second one that I will recall for you is one of my favorite cartoon characters, with whom I also identify, and he's Arthur in Miss Peach. And the Camp Kelly Glee Club is meeting, and Miss Peach says to Arthur, please join the listeners section. Thereupon, Arthur is asked, what's wrong, can't you sing? To this, Arthur quickly replies, we listeners are chosen for our earnestness of expression and our quietness of breathing. During the last decade, I become very concerned about the subject of listening. In spite of its overwhelming importance, most people have never learned to do it or do it well, and they spend very little time at it. Yet it's a very teachable skill. In a study, which I will not recall in detail for you, a survey was made for a couple of months of quite a number of people, and they found out, well, they already knew that as a given, that those of us who have ears and eyes, probably 98% of what we learn through them. And if you take a breakdown of this, of what people usually do in communications area, you probably find out that 70% of their day is spent in communication. And there in this particular group in Ohio, the breakdown went something like this. 9%, or around 10% of their time was spent in writing, about 15% in reading, 25 to 30% in speaking, and the overwhelming one was listening, with 45%. Some of you even do more, as I do. I feel I'm qualified to discuss this subject because I've been married 34 years, Sunday before last. Now, or maybe it was last Sunday. My wife isn't here, so I can guess at this. Now, one of the most important things that we do for another person is to listen to them. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, one of the great, certainly the great theologians of this age, said that one of the most important things that we do for our brother and our sister in the universal sense is to listen to them. I can recall on a few occasions when people have come to me and said, you know, Busted, you really helped me out that time. And I immediately recall now, what kind of a sage advice did I give this person? And then in all honesty, I have to remember that I really hadn't given them any advice at all, but that I had listened to them. I'm going to shorten this part and move directly then to my next law, which states that what one says to another should be determined by the answer to three questions. Is it kind? Is it true? Is it necessary? We're too often breaking people with our unkind words, our innuendos, our gossips, our untruths, and our lack of humor. When we break people, we have what we got, a broken world. In this regard, I hasten to add, however, that I belong to the C.S. Lewis philosophy here, and he said that no friend is a friend of mine if he doesn't care whether I lie, cheat, and steal. We owe it to one another to give one another constructive criticism, but very gently. I recall for you at this point from the book of Galatians, which is really the book for our season here in Holden. It's a book chosen for this year, this bicentennial year. And in my reading, and I always get up very early in the morning, and then I have a session in which I pray and I read some scripture. And in a recent reading, I was into Galatians for the fifth time this year, and I think it's the first verse of the last chapter of Galatians, which I'll recall one translation goes something like this: If a person errs, if he goofs up, you who are of the Spirit,
correct him very gently, very gently. We have to do it with warm fuzzies. But I recall in my own situation, some of the most important lessons of my life were hard lessons. They caused me to lose sleep for a very long period of time, for many days. Yet they saved me a lot of trouble through much of my life. So we do owe it to one another. And that's, I think, one of the great greatnesses here in Holden, where we challenge one another and our scholarship and our fuzzy thinking. My third law states that the trouble ain't that people don't know anything. The trouble is that most of what they know ain't true. And we have that in every era, in every area of our endeavor. We, for those of you who were at the lecture last night, in my own field that I know, I think, fairly well, all of the stuff I listen to, it causes me many times to become very nauseated because, as Goethe said, there's nothing more frightening than ignorance in action. I could expound on this at great length, but to realize the truth of it, all we have to probably do is to examine our own situation in our examinations, how we were sure that we knew something and we didn't. Or you can read the newspapers that are designed because people have a penchant for things that are terrible. They have a penchant for things that are bad news and for things that go boom. And so the papers cater to this because terror sells. We have not come very far since 1912 when one of the great men of medicine stood before the Yale graduating class in medicine. And he said, I have two disturbing bits of information for you. The first one is that half of what you have been taught isn't true. And the other thing that is even more disturbing is we don't know which half it is. And this is how the situation is. In biology and medicine, we must admit that our ignorance is very great, yet we're still rubbing two sticks together. Now and then we see a spark, but we have no fire. My fourth law holds that to believe that man acts logically is illogical. And it also applies to women. Plato realized this when he discussed misology, which he said is one of the worst things that can happen to a human being. A misologist is a person who, having become discouraged with his own ability at dialectics, that is, reasonable resolution of contradictions in argument, concludes that careful reasoning has no value, and thus he shifts the blame from himself and is from his own ineptitude. At this point, I am reminded of a passage from the Iliad. Agamemnon tries to explain why, on losing his own mistress, that he robbed Achilles of his. He said, Zeus took away my understanding. I think it was Shakespeare who said, it is not in our stars, but in ourselves that we are underlings. We have the modern version of Zeus today in our t-shirts. You've seen a lot of them. The devil made me do it. I have a cartoon that I wish I could show you at this point. A lady is on the beach at Miami under an umbrella talking to another lady. And she says, all that I know is that I stopped listening to reason and my headache was gone. Too many people are like the desert nomad who each evening would light his lamp and feast on a bowl of dates. And one evening, the first date that he picked up had a worm in it, so he laid it aside. Picked up another one, it also had a worm in it, so he laid it aside. He went over and blew out the lamp and then finished off the dates. The light of knowledge was something that he did not care to face. My fifth law states that self-discipline is the price of freedom. We hear much of freedom in the contemporary scene, and especially this year. And I'll probably have something to say about this tomorrow night at Vespers. Freedom, man, that's what it's all about. And then we go merrily on our way doing what we please. But it soon becomes obvious to the thinking person that many people must learn the hard way that empty freedom is a snare and a delusion. Doing what comes naturally or easily brings on only confusion, inner conflict, and disaster. Without discipline of time, for example, we spoil the next day the night before. We had an example of that recently. At this point, I recall T.H. Huxley's observation that a person's worst difficulties begin when he or she is able to do as he or she likes. And I'm working on another law now. It's in a subcategory now, but it'll become probably a law. And it is this: a people and a civilization collapses when you try to give them everything they want. As compassionate as we must be with others, we dare not be soft and indulgent with ourselves. Excellence comes at a price, and one of the major prices is inner control. We have not come very far if we have not faced the basic paradox of freedom, and it is this: we are most bound when we are free, but bound in a very special way. And what matters is the character of our binding, which is sort of like chemistry. And I'm reminded of what we heard just within the last 2 days about the laws, how the Jews regarded the laws. They were boundaries within which they could be comfortable. The athlete who is unwilling to discipline his or her body by regular exercise or rigorous self-discipline is not free to excel on either track or field. Failure to train rigorously denies him or her the freedom to clear the bar at the desired height or break the tape in the desired time with speed and endurance. And what I've said of the athlete also applies to the scientist, to the artist, to the musician, to students, just to everyone. Yes, self-discipline is the price of freedom, and freedom is necessary to be creative. The true test of freedom is not so much what we are free to do, but what we are free not to do. One of the best illustrations of this is in Solzhenitsyn's One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, which brings out the spiritual aspects of this, and I'll recall this for the rest of the people tomorrow night, probably. But Alyoshka's freedom had nothing to do with guards, barbed wire, the horrible conditions of a Siberian prison camp. It was inside of him, God-given and permanent. And the secret was really in the gospel that he had secreted away and that he read every day. My sixth law states that a person is a whole person only to the extent that he or she possesses compassion, reverence, and intellectual integrity. Dr. Albert Schweitzer, whose 100th anniversary we just celebrated within the last couple of years, has reminded us of these three ingredients more than most in our lifetime. He was honored, as few men are in their lifetime, for what he really was. He was a whole person. He possessed great compassion, which was manifest in his plaintive call, "We live in a dark and frightening age. This results from science and technological development of weapons with increased destructiveness. This has led to a sharp rise in inhuman actions and in human ideology." He asks, "When will all the killing that necessity imposes upon us be undertaken with sorrow?" We can hear the same plaintive call in our contemporary scene with our folk songs, such as "Blowin' in the Wind." The lyric asks, "How many times can a man turn his head and pretend that he just doesn't see?" Dr. Schweitzer also taught us reverence for life, and he had the intellectual integrity to call things as he saw them. Relative to his reverence for life, he stated, "But the ethic of reverence for life constrains all to give themselves as men to men who need human help and sympathy. It does not allow the scholar to live for his science alone, even if he is very useful to his community in so doing. It demands from all that they should sacrifice a portion of their own lives for others." In "Out of My Life and Thought," he said, "A man is ethical only when life as such is sacred to him. That of plants and animals is that of his fellow men, and when he devotes himself helpfully to all life that is in the need of help." And he also said about humane man, "He feels the happiness in helping living things and shielding them from suffering and annihilation." I recall at this point a story of a landlady in London, England, who was concerned about one of her tenants. He was despondent and was threatening to jump into the river. She tried to talk him out of it for at least one reason. He owed her 2 weeks of rent. He said, "I'll tell you what I'll do. I'm going to walk to the river now, and if I meet just one person who gives me a word of hope or cheer, or even just a smile, I'll be back." He never came back. And we must ask ourselves, could he have met us? My seventh law is that intelligence can coexist with a want of sensibility and sensitivity. Reverence for life is of great significance, to me and in my work, for I work with animals. Dr. Schweitzer remarked about those who experiment with animals, it is their duty to ponder in every separate case whether it is really and truly necessary thus to sacrifice an animal for humanity. They ought to be filled with anxious care to alleviate as much as possible the pain which they cause. My associates and I have to ask before any manipulation of any animal, is this trip necessary? You must also ask this question if you deal with animals. I have noted that people generally, in many areas, have little regard for life of lower forms, and it is therefore, that's the reason that I remind you of this. We must show sensibility and sensitivity also to our animals, and the greater of these is sensitivity. And I have a prayer I teach to the children here on their bird walks. It goes like this. Bless thy beasts and singing birds, and guard with tenderness small things that have no words. The next two laws I'll give you without comment. The eighth law states, and I'll repeat it for those of you who did not hear it last night, there is no complex problem which, if looked at in the proper way, doesn't become more complex. And the ninth law states, you can't tell people what they need to know because they want to know something else. I really stole that from George MacDonald. You'll notice that in going through today, I recall the writings of many people, and that's your assignment. You read them too if you haven't. The tenth law states that the mantle of the prophet lies uneasily on the scientist. And you recall that story last night about David Halberstam's The Best and the Brightest. The scene was set, and I'm going to go over just a little bit. I like that time better than mine. But the scene was set. Jack Kennedy, as president, had brought in the best and the brightest to Washington. Every week there was another headliner. And he finally assembled all these people. And at the last moment, he realized that the vice president wasn't there. So he got on the horn and he got Lyndon Johnson down. He came charging in there. And Lyndon sat there listening to the best and the brightest. And they had the whole scene all outlined well, and the predictions for the future. They had it all laid out, and it made a lot of sense to Lyndon. And he was so impressed with these that he ran over to see his old friend Sam Rayburn, who didn't have the privilege of this. And he went on at great length to tell about the greatness of these men, how they had everything figured out. And I suppose after a few expletives, Sam said to Lyndon, you may be right, and they may be every bit as intelligent as you say, but I'd feel just a lot better if one of them had run for sheriff just once. They hadn't been on the scene. It's just like Al Pitcher said this morning, you know, to really learn it, you should get in there and work with them. And like the Indian said, you walk a couple of miles in the other person's moccasins. My 11th law states that facts aren't everything. Most people don't argue with facts given in evidence in this day and age. Even Adam didn't either. In Genesis 3:6 are listed good and sufficient facts to justify getting hooked on apples from a certain tree. Recall the facts. The apples on this tree were good for food, a delight to the eyes, and able to make one wise. With such advantages, think how many we could sell on television today. These facts give one confidence. You can't argue with facts like that, do you? Or consider these facts. An aeroplane that flies 1,500 miles an hour. A defoliant that defoliates everything. A bug killer that kills every bug. That's what we want, isn't it? Those facts really instill confidence. They make the product marketable and acceptable. And this serves to introduce the subject of the ends and the means with my 12th law. That nightingales sing better if you put out their eyes is not sufficient reason to put out their eyes. A discussion of the means and the end used to be a philosophical discussion. Now it is expressed in terms of technical facts on the basis of which one makes a practical decision. Today it seems everything has become means. We have lost our way, or perhaps more correctly, we don't know where we are going. We ignore the end and we have concentrated on the means. We set huge machines in motion in order to arrive nowhere. That doesn't say we don't have some ends, to succeed in competition, to get higher salaries, to get a newer car, a bigger house, but these ends are not valid. People must be total producers. They must be obedient consumers, ingesting everything that economics puts in their mouth, that is, tells them about on television. While trying to obtain for people their happiness, we are turning them into instruments of modern gods, means. And these modern gods are no better than the new batches of gods shipped in from the East to Olympus in Caesar's day, when the old gods of Rome were dying. For these gods were no better than the old ones, for a whole pantheon of modern gods are worthless if they have nothing to say to a person with a broken heart. What really happens in this technological age is that people become means, and it happens so logically. In order to make people happy, we must give them plenty of goods to consume. And to achieve this, production must be organized and then consumption adapted to production. Few people are moved to ask where we are going or to check the direction we are moving. The end seems to have disappeared. Means seem to create more means. New kinds of production appear because new machines have been created, or we have discovered new ways of exploiting matter. It is of little or no consequence that we may not need these new products, or that these new products are really useless, like umbilical brushes for the man who has everything. We rejoice whenever a new speed record is realized, and we work harder to go even faster, often killing many people in the process, as if speed were a valid end in itself. But thereby we save so much time. For what? We do the same in the healing arts to extend the work of healing. Some of my associates and I have worked long days and not a few nights and weekends on the elusive cause of cancer, or causes, on means for early diagnosis and controls to save lives. But why? In too many places today, life and time no longer have meaning. People don't seem to know what to do with their time. Proof enough of this is the hour spent by millions in front of the idiot box, drinking beer, eating popcorn, and growing bigger and bigger waffle butts and smaller minds. Life has become more absurd than ever. Why? Because the spiritual foundations of time and life have been destroyed in the hearts of people. The autocracy of means has also invaded the spiritual spheres. Modern man has been dehumanized by means, and so life and time are of no real significance. If one would examine this situation carefully, probably he or she would find that no civilization has been so wasteful of time and life of human beings than ours. The means now justify the means. For in our day, everything that succeeds, everything that is effective, everything that is efficient is justified. The measuring criteria are quicker, greater, more precise. We're surrounded by marvelous successes while people starve. When practices become general, people accept them. The Russian communist does not shudder over the camps in Siberia. The Nazis in Germany, in fact, many Germans I saw in 1944 and 1945 as a prisoner of war, were not horrified by the presence of extermination camps. Alexander Pope describes this process in an essay on man, on vice. A monster of such evil mien, as to be hated needs but to be seen, but seen too oft, familiar with her face, you first endure, then pity, then embrace. We have become immune to catastrophic dimension. People being killed, yes, even mass genocide, doesn't seem to shake us anymore. At this point, I recall for you an experiment described by an acquaintance of mine, Jerome Frank, who's a PhD and also a physician at Johns Hopkins. And in his book, Sanity and Survival, which was also recently described on television, he has something to say about humaneness. As stated in this book, and it was an experiment involving students and some other adults, and these people believed that the purpose of the experiment was to study the effect of punishment on learning. And each subject was to present a fellow subject who was really an experimenter's accomplice with a simple learning task and then shock him each time that he made a mistake. Every detail of the setting was arranged so that the subject was completely convinced that he was administering shocks. The shocks were administered by a machine on which the voltage level was very plainly marked, starting with 15 volts and increasing by 15 volt steps to 450 volts. The levels were also labeled. 300 volts was intense shock, 420 dangerous, severe shock, and the two highest levels were just marked X, X, X. Before the experiment began, the subject saw electrodes placed on the accomplice, who was then strapped to a chair in a neighboring room. The actual experiment involved signaling a series of problems to the accomplice, who signaled his answer back. The accomplice made frequent errors in accordance with a prearranged schedule. And since the subject had been told to increase the shock by 15 volts after each error, he had to keep increasing the severity of the shock. At 300 volts, the accomplice pounded the wall and thereafter stopped signaling answers. At this point, the subject was told to regard failure to respond as an error and to continue to administer shocks. The accomplice pounded the wall once more at 315 volts and then was not heard from again. Whenever the subject demurred, the experimenter told him to continue with increasing urgency, the most forceful command being, "You have no other choice. You must go on." The findings are disturbing. All subjects administered shocks up to painful shock at 300 volts, and 62%, almost two-thirds of those involved, went to the maximum, 450 volts, two levels beyond danger, severe shock. Certainly this gives us some real cause for deep concern as we contemplate the future. People in many quarters no longer seek to know themselves in order that they may acquire self-mastery. As a result, they are used not by God, but by a system or by a machine. They have given up seeking to discover their true selves and have been reduced to a state of facsimile. And this brings me to Law 13. One cannot live effectively without meaning for his or her life. The why of life is infinitely more important than the how of life. Many people are motivated or dominated by a will to pleasure, not a few by a will to power. But the aware person is dominated by a longing and a striving to find meaning for life, the ultimate meaning of life itself. They are dominated by a will to meaning. Nietzsche understood this when he said, "If we have our own why for life, we can get along with almost any how." Albert Camus addressed this too in Caligula, when one of the characters states, "To lose one's life is no great matter. When the time comes, I'll have the courage to lose mine. But what's intolerable is to see one's life being drained of meaning, to be told there's no reason for existing. A man can't live without some reason for living." In an address at Concordia College, Al Rognes, who is one of the great human beings of all time and who was here at the Holden Village some weeks ago, made this point so well in his discussion of the ultimate question, why live? He asked the farmer, "What do you do?" "I raise pigs." "Why?" "So people can eat." "Why should they eat?" "So they can live." "Why should they live?" "So they can raise more pigs." And the tragedy of it all is that's the story of too many lives. And this brings me to Law 14, where I will stop. This law states, "You shall love." It's what the Danish philosopher Kierkegaard called the royal law. And I recall for you at this point that we have a lay seminar series that started about 13 or 14 years ago with a small group, and Al Rognes was there, and Carolyn Mary, and just a few others. And we started with The Works of Love by Kierkegaard. It was translated by Edna and Howie Hong. We're also great friends of the village. And we like Edna especially because she gives us a cut of her royalties on all her books, and they're getting better all the time. And required reading is Bright Valley of Love, which you can hopefully buy in our bookstore. But this is how we started the lay series here at Holden, where more love is manifest than any other community in which I have had any experience. Now I'm going to close with a few quotations. The first one is from the poet Auden, who said, "We must learn to love or die." And we all need this. In Mother Night, Kurt Vonnegut's Campbell said, "No matter what I was really, no matter what I really meant on critical love is what I needed and my Helga was the angel who gave it to me copiously. No young person on earth is so excellent in all respects as to need no uncritical love. And this love at work in a person or in a community transforms. And I say it's best exemplified here. It knows intellectual charity, vulnerability, peace, and joy. With it, one learns to live with few defenses and with one's deficiencies without being judgmental. There is a naturalness, a healing quality, and a wholesomeness about it that one would give almost anything to share. To see it at work is to know that's how it ought to be. A great scientist and a scholar had something to say about this too, and he is Vannevar Bush, who was one of my idols through my entire scientific career. He just recently died. And he said this: the process of evolution did not teach us to rejoice in the beauty of nature, nor did it produce the concepts of honor and integrity. The making of a poem or the benediction of music in an open field at dusk has little to do with crass survival. Yet here they are. Love can reach far higher than the needs of propagation demand. It can produce new life, but it can also make life worth living. And then two more. From The Little Prince, and that's also required reading, and if you read French, that's even better. So you read it in the original. "Here is my secret," said the fox to the little prince, "a very simple secret. It is only with the heart that one can see rightly. What is essential is invisible to the eye." I will close with a story from Loren Isley, who in his book, The Unexpected Universe, paints a very haunting picture of a star thrower. It's a book that Rudy Edmonds loaned me one day. It is a picture that I shall never forget, and I hope you don't either. He tells about walking along the beach at Costabel, a beach that was littered with debris of life, where he said death walks hugely and in many forms. Isley seemed to think that the sea was rejecting its offspring. The life form seemed to be trying to get back into the sea, only to be cast again, rejected upon the shore. And among these were starfish with their arms thrust out stiffly, holding their bodies away from the stifling sand, and of course scorching in the hot sun. And as he walked along, Isley came upon a stranger leaning over one of these starfish, and he ventured to say, "It's still alive." "Yes," said the stranger, and with a quick yet gentle movement, he picked up the star and he spun it far out into the sea. "It may live," he said, "if the offshore pull is strong enough." Isley walked on, and then he looked back. For a moment in the changing light, the soar appeared magnified, as though casting larger stars upon some greater sea. He had at any rate the posture of a god, Isley said. But then Isley walked away from the star thrower in the hardened indifference of maturity. He was an observer and a scientist, and the star thrower was mad. Later, after reflection, he returned to the beaches. "Silently I sought and picked up a still living star, spinning it far out into the waves. I spoke once briefly. 'I understand,' I said. 'Call me another thrower.' Only then I allowed myself to think, 'He is not alone any longer. After us, there will be others.' I have told you this today to remind you that we must hurl back living stars. As Isley recognized, we must cast slowly, deliberately, and well. The task was not to be assumed lightly, for it was men as well as starfish that we sought to save. We should keep the memory of the perfect circle of compassion from life to death and back again to life. For somewhere there is a hurler of stars. May you too all be hurlers of stars. If we're not here to help our fellow men and women, we probably have no good reason to be here at all. Amen."